Rewind is a production of Wisconsin Eye. To keep programs like this free and accessible to all, please consider a charitable gift to wiseye.org/donate or text WISEYE to 44321. This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Nomination papers are in. We have you covered on which candidates made the cut to be on the ballot this fall. Plus, Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin can't see eye to eye on gun reform. But can Congress reach a compromise? And the Milwaukee Common Council passes a framework to host the Republican National Convention. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 3rd.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., we're going to start with the newest story of the week that dropped last night, as former President Donald Trump endorsed in the Wisconsin governor's race, and he went to Tim Michaels. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I think immediately after, within moments, I would say, after his announcement came out, we heard from Rebecca Clayfish. And I think the storyline behind this, JR, is that it really, really is a blow to Rebecca Clayfish's campaign. She's been campaigning the longest. She's trying to be loyal to Trump for a very long time. We had all of the four candidates go to, or all but Kevin Nicholson, visit Mar-a-Lago, asking basically Trump for his blessing. First, let me just read some of Trump's statement and Michaels, how he's kind of celebrating this, and then we'll get into the weeds about this. Former President Donald Trump said, Wisconsin needs a governor who will stop inflation, uphold the rule of law, strengthen our borders, and end the well-documented fraud in our elections. Tim Michaels is the best candidate to do that. Tim Michaels, of course, said this is a tremendous boost to his campaign, especially because he was the latecomer. He announced in late April. So first, let's kind of just talk about how this is really just a dramatic shakeup in the GOP primary that he went for Michaels.
It could be, if Tim Michaels uses it properly. So let's pull back and look at the Trump record endorsements. In federal races, pretty good. Gubernatorial races, a little bit mixed lately. So we've got three examples that come on top of my head. Pennsylvania, Doug Mastriano, I think is how you say his name, a state senator. He got endorsed by Trump the Saturday before the Tuesday primary last month. He won. However, Doug had been leading the polls already. There was an effort to try and stop him because people thought he was unelectable because he's part of, I think he was at the January 6th violent protest, the Capitol, all that kind of stuff. So he was already in the lead, right? Over in Idaho, Trump endorsed Lieutenant Governor. They're doing a little bit differently. She took on the governor in the primary. She lost by 20 points. Georgia is Trump's personal vendetta against Governor Kemp over 2020. He won by 50 points, all right? Now, there's different dynamics in all those races, including with Kemp in Georgia. He had a lot more money than Perdue did, the former U.S. senator. So, yes, Trump's blessing is significant, but what do you do with it?
Right.
So for Michaels, smartly, right after he got the endorsement, he recut an ad already up in the air about immigration to add in the Trump endorsement. Okay, great. What else is he going to do? Is Trump going to come here and campaign for him? I haven't seen Trump do a lot of stumping for people. Now some.
He's done some, yeah.
Some, not a lot. Now come here. How is Michael's going to use the ad, what I've been, or the endorsement? What I've been hearing is Michaels has a significant edge on Clayfish for TV since he got in the race, but it's not like insurmountable. So what's Michaels going to do now? Because Clayfish's numbers, from what I'm hearing, are that her polling has her still up about the same spot she's been, even growing a little bit. So in some way, Michaels has to take this away from her. How does he do that? Well, does he do a contrast ad? So are some people's contrast, other people's negative, right? But do you say Rebecca Clayfish is a bad person because she did X, Y, and Z, or just contrast, I'm for this, she's for this? Like not quite a negative ad, but more of a, here's what I'm about. What do you do? Because you have to take it away from her. The endorsement should help, but it's not going to seal the deal for Michaels. He still has to do things. And oh, by the way, nobody's going to punch yet in this primary. Clayfish has not seen a punch from her in the ads, but Michaels hasn't either. He's got issues like he was living in New York and his kids went to school in Connecticut. There are some questions about, okay, he really took it to Wisconsin with that going on. Where has he been on right to work and Act 10, these big conservative fights the last decade or so that Clayfish was a part of in the Walker administration? So the dust hasn't settled on the how the brawl is going to be fought just yet.
Right, and you got to give Clayfish, well, basically some credit because mm-hmm. she did get very, very close to winning the mm-hmm. state party's endorsement. She fell short, I think, about 46%, if I'm top of my
55.
Head. Oh, 55. Oh, I'm so sorry.
53, 54.
Yeah, like so, you know, she also kind of touted that in mm-hmm. her statement immediately and says, you know, if I know one thing about President Trump, it's that he likes winners. And so she touted winning four statewide elections. Of course, two of those, she was on the ticket with Walker. One was a recall. One was her Republican primary mm-hmm. for lieutenant governor. So I would agree with you, too. It's not end-all, be-all. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens, you know, if Trump's endorsement is influential here in Wisconsin because it's worked in other states. It hasn't worked in others.
The Marquette poll that came out recently had a split in the GOP base about whether Trump's endorsement would sway one way or the other. There's that. Clayfish, for whatever reason, Trump, from what I've heard, doesn't think she's, like, sufficiently loyal to him. Go back to 2020. I've got a picture from the Clayfish campaign of her doing a bus tour for Trump. They say, hey, she was on board. But she wasn't a delegate at the 2016 National Convention. You know Trump. I mean, we know Trump's reputation. Mm-hmm. I don't pretend to know the man, but he values loyalty, right? There's a view that she's not sufficiently loyal to him for whatever reason. And Michaels is more in the mold of what Trump is, right? From the private sector, business guy, outsider. You know, Michaels Corporation does big things, like Keystone Pipeline. They're working on that before it was shut down. They dug giant tunnels in New York, right, for the subway system. Trump likes big things. Michaels Corporation does big things. There's a kind of a connection there. Also, there are people in Wisconsin Republican circles who have Trump's ear who are kind of, you know, advocating for Michaels. People like Reince Priebus, the former state national chair, Trump's former chief of staff. He's like kind of the Michaels camp. Tommy Thompson, he was on a, you know, when he was thinking about running for governor as well, down to Florida, he gave a stem winder, I heard, for Michaels at an event last night. Diane Hendricks, the big donor from Beloit, she did an event for Michaels, a luncheon to kind of let people see what he had to say. She also talks to Trump. So it's not just like having one voice, it's all these voices that Trump knows in Wisconsin are saying, hey, we like this guy. Those voices outweighed those who are advocating for Clayfish, it seems like, at least.
All right. So we got a lot to get to. So we're going to go next topic about the filing deadline was this week. So we kind of got a taste of who made the cut and who mm-hmm. didn't. And JR, in general, it wasn't as dramatic, I guess, as you could say, as 2020 was. But they actually had some changes there, too. First, I want to note that they kind of had a time. They had a ticker to make sure you were there on time, a lot more staff, a hands on deck. But let's just dive into the details. I mean, what are your key takeaways here?
So Republicans have more than a dozen incumbents who faced primary challenges from U.S. Senate down to the legislature. That's kind of interesting to note. Only one Democratic office holder got a challenger for primary. That's Doug LaFollette, Secretary of State, who's been he was first elected when I was still in diapers. That said, Republicans have an issue. There is a base issue where the base is somewhat split about various things. And looking at the field, I don't know that these guys are in any trouble, right? Ron Johnson's not going to lose a GOP primary to somebody that we don't really know who this person is, other than he filed and got 2,000 signatures. Three members of the Congress, Glenn Grothman, Tom Tiffany, Mike Gallagher, again, little-known challengers. These guys are all well-known. They've got lots of money. I don't think they're in any trouble. At the legislative level, you kind of go, okay, it's hard to predict. Like, for example, James Edmond. The guy challenging him lost by 14 votes in the GOP primary 8 years ago and brought that up in his Facebook post about why he's running this time, thinking that you're not getting much out of the current incumbent right now. I'm challenging because of that. Devin Lemahue, Senator Leader, he's got two challengers. One, who spoke at 2020 decertification rallies, another who advocated against COVID vaccine mandates and other masking issues, right? But you have two challengers in a primary. They split the anti-incumbent vote. That's an issue. Van Wongard, his challenger is a part of Open, Honest, Transparent Government, Racine. This is kind of this ground zero for like the conspiracy theories about 2020, right? That's his challenger. There are all kinds of issues being raised by folks, but they're not necessarily well-known people. I don't know you're going to see lots of incumbents go down. I think Republicans worry more about the primaries in open, safe Republican seats. Because in some, you got a half dozen candidates. Start doing some math, you can win a primary with 20% of the vote and get through, and you could be somebody's more extreme voice in the party. Well, how is that going to work with a caucus that's already got some tensions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's their bigger worry, is not these guys and the challenges that they face on August 9th, but what happens to those open seats where you have potentially people who could, I don't know, raise some cane in the caucus come January.
And we also kind of noticed some people not putting in nominations signatures for the lieutenant governor's race, which you broke, I believe, last week and this week. Ben Vogel is not going to run anymore. He spoke at the convention. David Bowen, former state representative, well, he obviously still is not going to stay state representative, but said due to his mother's passing, just decided to get
still
out of
mourning.
It. So some of those races narrowed just a little bit, but still a lot of candidates on both sides for that office.
One quick note, we call it a free ride. You have no primary opponent and no general election opponent. There's one person I found, Ryan Clancy of Milwaukee. Jonathan Brostoff, the state rep, is leaving to run for Milwaukee Common Council. Kind of a late announcement, he's not going to run. As of this morning, Ryan's the only person with signatures in to get in, so he gets a free ride. So welcome, Ryan. barring a massive write-in campaign, he's going to be a member of the Assembly come this fall. There are also, I believe, 5 seats in the Senate where Democrats did not find a candidate. So Lemahue, for example, doesn't face anybody. So if he wins his primary, no challenge on the November ballot. That's one of them. It's kind of interesting, the dynamic for Democrats of it looks like a bad year, and we went from maps that Evers drew, the court picked originally, to maps Republicans drew. It seemed like a gut punch to Democrats of like they had recruited with that first map in mind. Once it switched, they had people go, okay, one, I'm not in the seat I was in before. Two, this map's not good for us. Yeah. It's kind of like a morale deflator for folks. That might be why they had trouble finding some candidates in some seats.
All right. Next topic this week is, of course, every year I will say Governor Evers, at least since he's been in office, always raises the pride flag because it's Pride Month and June 1st started it. And there's always controversy around it. This year he had some, you know, same criticism when he rose the flag. But when he was asked some questions, he was in generally his speech before the raising ceremony talked about the massive amounts of anti-LGBTQ bills that we've seen here in Wisconsin, but also nationally. I found that over 300 anti-LGBT bills have been introduced in state legislatures nationwide. That's according to the Human Rights Campaign. And then when he was asked some questions about what if or what do you fear what would happen if a Republican takes over? Are you worried the flag might not take, flag ceremony might not happen anymore? And here's what Evers had to say, basically talking about LGBTQ literature, thinking that's going to be starting to be banned in schools. So let's first take a listen.
There's lots of Republican legislators at this point in time that are spending time working with essentially looking at the books and other materials that are in schools, and you can be damn sure that after they come out, they're going to be putting themselves in charge of banning books in the state of Wisconsin, and you can be damn sure some of it's going to be directly related to LGBTQ community efforts. This legislature and a Republican governor would be banning books in the state of Wisconsin. It's breathtaking.
So when Evers started talking about books in school and their content, it was kind of in response to Republicans or a report by the Wisconsin Examiner basically talking about how Republicans are circulating a list that's going around that we could see this if a Republican governor comes into office, defeats Governor Evers, they might start doing this and removing books that's happening in other states. We've had this discussion before, JR, about critical race theory. Mm-hmm. So it's just not Wisconsin that it could happen to. We're kind of seeing this as a national trend overall.
Yep. Representative Jesse James, who's running for the state Senate, open Senate seat, one of the ones was no Democratic challenger in that seat as well, basically is saying kind of a Republican argument of we think parents should have say-so over what's in the libraries of these schools. This is about banning books but giving parental oversight of what's going on in their kids' schools and their lives. So that's her perspective. But yeah, I mean, you talk about critical race theory, LGBTQ issues, abortion issues, election issues. The stakes are quite high this fall.
Yeah, and he was talking a lot about those bills too, the parental rights bill that you were talking about, basically that would allow parents to sue school districts if they don't agree with what's being said or talked about in the classroom. We also saw the bill banning transgender youth to participate in sports. So those are all things that could possibly come up. if a Republican governor is elected in the fall. Want to kind of transition to gun safety prevention. It is Gun Safety Prevention Week starting today, and it carries on for a few days. But, of course, even just after the horrific Texas school shooting, there was multiple mass shootings after that. So Democrats had another press conference kind of kicking off National Gun Violence Awareness Day, and they just once again, you know, basically pled with Republicans or called out for them, please come sit down with us. We can't get anything done without you. But mostly all of those calls have been ignored. Democrats have been on the same beat. They want to have universal background checks, red flag laws, which would take guns away from people who pose a threat to themselves or others. Republicans, we talked about this last week, looks like Assembly Speaker Voss and other top Republicans really just rather go the beef up security route. Let's put SROs back in schools. Let's have police officers in there. Let's arm possibility of arming teachers as long as they have a law enforcement background. So I did ask Senator Agard at her press conference, well, what do you think about arming teachers? Is it something you maybe could find middle ground on? What about having more school safety grants under the DOJ? And here's what she had to say.
Attorney General Josh Call and the legislature has provided a lot of money to schools across the state of Wisconsin to create safety within our schools. That does not stop the gun violence from occurring. What we need to prevent is the guns in the hands of people who are a danger to themselves and a danger to our communities. And that's what these two pieces of legislation do. They will not affect the Second Amendment. They will not affect law-abiding gun owners. They will only make sure that people who are a danger to themselves and other people, the state of Wisconsin, or our nation, from having access to those guns.
On the congressional level, we are seeing some talks that are not happening here in Wisconsin, some bipartisan talks. Congress, there's a group of bipartisan group of senators that are kind of floating some ideas. They've apparently tried to reach this framework as of yesterday that would raise the age from 18 to 21 to buy an assault-style weapon, also discussing red flag laws. But it really just kind of remains to be seen what Congress does. But I think it's fair to say that the state legislature is not going to come back. Maybe Governor Evers might call special session, but we knew what happened in 2019, or even with all the special sessions have been ignored by Republicans. But we're kind of just in a wait and see period.
Yeah, no, with everything Joe Biden said in the speech, you know, you have to have 10 Republican senators agree to anything that comes up to give over filibuster, and the prospects of that are not real great. So we'll see. Now, one Republican I saw did say that not doing anything would be an embarrassment after what's happened in the last week, but let's see.
Yeah, exactly. Also this week, Milwaukee Common Council reached an agreement on their framework if they get to host the Republican National Convention. I mean, in general, it was a big step because they were the first, besides Nashville, they are the two competing. They kind of got out ahead of this because they're really, really trying to sell this to land here. We heard from Cavalier Johnson, who said, basically, we reached an important step in our work to win this convention. However, there is some criticism, especially from an immigrant group, Voces de la Frontera. They have not wanted the RNC to come to Milwaukee for a whole host of reasons. They just think it would be a bad look. They don't think Milwaukee is going to get the economic boost that everyone keeps predicting. I think it's around the 2 million range that would be funneled back into the city. So I guess there's always someone who's not going to be happy with it. But I think in general, I think it was just a good first step. We'll see what happens. And we'll remain to be seen because we are fighting with Nashville right now. And there should be a decision, I'm hearing, by the end of this month.
Important to note, some people have pushed for an amendment that would require the RNC to pay $6 million to the city to kind of make them whole. That didn't come to fruition, which is why in the past 13-0, there is, though, talk about doing something like RNC trying to do some kind of compensation for Milwaukee. Milwaukee's other issue has been crime. There's been a number of incidents recently that have raised questions about whether people feel safe about coming to Milwaukee. The flip side is, you ever covered a national convention in a major city, it's like a war zone. Like, you are blocked off.
Oh, yeah.
I was in New York in 2004 for the first convention post 9/11. It was like being in a war zone. So there are ways to kind of wall off the conventioners from the rest of the city. That said, it's a perception problem for Milwaukee that they'll have to face and address the RNC if they're going to win the convention.
Right. Also this week, Wisconsin State Supreme Court joined other state high courts on Wednesday that found businesses who claim that their losses stem from COVID-19 pandemic are not covered by insurance. So this was kind of a long time coming, I guess, ruling JR, and it was a unanimous decision. And like I mentioned before, mostly all other courts that have taken up this issue just basically argue that COVID-19's presence doesn't amount to physical loss of staff and other damages.
So it's one policy from Century Base in Fond du Lac. It was one business that sued originally, but others joined in, arguing that, look, we had to shut down because of the order from the Evers administration, and then we had COVID present in the building, which causes issues, so we should be able to recoup our lost revenue. The court said, all right, your policy talks about damages. That's damage to the building. That's not like being shut down. That's like you got to do something to it. That doesn't count. And oh, by the way, you could still use a facility. You just couldn't have the dine-in part of your operation. It doesn't count. Yes, this is like other courts have found, it is, though, a blow for businesses who want to try and find a way to make up for lost revenue. Evers has been handing out checks left and right to businesses for lost revenue from COVID. It doesn't make everybody whole, though, and here's an example of them not being whole.
All right, we will get to stock picks. And this week, you have John Jagler.
Yeah, so look, the fallout from the maps reverberates even in the filing deadline. Under the Evers map the court originally blessed, John Jagler was going to need a seat that goes from his Watertown-based district all the way to Madison, the north side of Madison, even like gets within like a couple miles of my house on the east side of Madison. Well, the court went back to the Republican map. Jagler has a plus 16 or 17 GOP seat and no opponent. So he goes from having potentially one of the top races in the Senate this fall to having a free ride to re-election. Now go back, Jagler won the seat in a special election in after Scott Fitzgerald became Congressman Fitzgerald. So in 2021, won the special. It was kind of closer than people thought because there was a Trump-like candidate on the ballot plus a Democrat. But it's a better seat for him than the map could have been. It's an example of what happens when the maps are so good for Republicans. Chris Kapinga also has a free ride among Republicans in the state Senate. Very, very red seat. The difference for him is his seat was always deep red. Even though Evers' map is deep red, Jagler goes from having to sweat it out to being able to relax this fall all the way through to another four-year term.
All right. And Mix, this week, we've talked about this race quite a lot and the importance of the state Supreme Court race that will be happening in February of next year. We have another one who threw their hat in the race, Everett Mitchell.
Yeah, Dane County Judge. There's an interesting split among progressives. If Everett is the right candidate to ignite the base in a spring election or if he's unelectable. And let's talk about the plus first. He's a Dane County judge. Dane County is a base for Democrats. It drives, they help drive turnout in elections. He's seeking to become the first black jurist elected to the Supreme Court. Louis Butler served on the court after being appointed by then-Governor Jim Doyle. Progressives have struggled to turn out black voters in Milwaukee in spring races often. Maybe Everett could help turn them out. The flip side is Everett also went to, as a social justice kind of advocate, went to a protest in 2020 after the old George Floyd thing and led a chain of no justice, no peace, no racist police. Now, if you're a sitting judge in Dane County, probably not a big issue. But in a statewide race for Supreme Court, I'm going to guess Republicans might use that in their ad campaign in April of 2023. Now, we have Janet Petrosiewicz from Milwaukee County. Her, we talked last week. She's a sitting judge. She's a former prosecutor. Everett is as well. She can self-finance. She's also female. Progressives have had a good run
of luck.
They
have a good run, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca Dallet, Jill Karofsky, they've done well with that profile of a candidate. She also has baggage. I mean, Republicans are already talking about a couple of cases that she ruled on where they're going, okay, she's soft on crime. Oh, by the way, her time as a DA also was intertwined with John Chisholm. It was a lightning rod about, you know, low bail for, you know, people charged with violent crimes. He's got pluses and minuses. The question is, who's the best profile in a spring election? For progressives, they got this choice. Now, I hesitate to say who's better right now because we are eternity away from spring of 2023.
Let's get through
things could
the
change
midterms
dramatically.
First.
What I'm setting up for is the choice progressives have. Now, Daniel Kelly, the former Supreme Court justice who lost to Karofsky in 2020, he's all but assured of running. I think he's just waiting for the filing deadline, June 30th, for this current finance period. So in July, I expect him to announce he's going to run. It looks like his are coalescing around him. I haven't heard of any liberals looking to run at this point. Some can still kick the tires, but do the math. You're going to have most likely kind of a 50-50 roughly turnout in the primary. So Daniel Kelly should get through. It's how do Everett and Janet split up the rest of the vote from the progressive side? And what choice do they make? Do they go with somebody who excites the base more, which people argue Everett does, or somebody who is better in a general election campaign like Janet? Again, those dynamics of who can turn people out in April when the electorate is simply older, whiter, and more conservative in Wisconsin than the November election.
All right. And following this week is the Thomas More Society, basically striking out again in court.
So, look, they've been on the warpath about private funds being used for public election costs for a while. The attorney for Thomas More Society filed a lawsuit in 2020 trying to prevent the five largest cities in Wisconsin from using these grants from the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which is funded mostly by Mark Zuckerberg, right? The federal judge said there's no ban on this money being used. There was strike one. After they went to the federal appeals court, struck out again. Then after the election, they went to the Elections Commission, filed a complaint. The commission denied the complaint. Then they filed five separate circuit court appeals in each of those five jurisdictions, saying this was not properly done. They also already announced election bribery. This is the first time one of those five cases, the appeals, got a hearing and a decision. Judge Elke said, there's nothing illegal here. You haven't proven there's anything illegal. Oh, by the way, we know it's not illegal because the legislature tried to ban explicitly the use of this money. So now they got to figure out what they're going to do next. Talking to Eric Cardall, the attorney for Thomas More Society, said, okay, we know we lost this. We may drop the other four lawsuits and focus on these other lawsuits we filed about the Wisconsin elections. Remember, the state Supreme Court at any minute now can have a decision about drop boxes. And whether unmanned drop boxes are legal or not in Wisconsin. The society has filed five circuit court actions. Again, the five cities, Green Bay, Kenosha, Madison, Milwaukee, and Racine, saying they can't use drop boxes. Well, why would you file the lawsuits when you already have this kind of supreme authority of state law going to rule? The explanation is the clerks in those communities weren't parties to that Supreme Court case. And the Waukesha County judge who said drop boxes aren't legal back in January, the decision was, the clerks and some of you said, well, we weren't parties, it doesn't apply to us. So like I believe in Madison, for example, still used drop boxes in April. I believe Milwaukee did as well.
Yeah.
Or no, it was Milwaukee and Racine, I think some combination of them. But anyway, their final lawsuits to try an explicit ruling saying that these guys can't use them as a safeguard against where the court decides. Now, I don't know the Supreme Court's going to decide. They can kind of do whatever they want to do
right,
to the Supreme
right.
Court. But that's their legal path. I don't know they're going to be successful with that path either. But they have the money and the resources to keep filing these lawsuits and keep trying to raise these concerns. And there are Republicans who don't like drop boxes, who don't like the private money. It is the focus of Gabelman's investigation.
Just going to bring that up, yes.
Oh, by the way, the society has been part of Gabelman's stuff as well and have helped him with what he's been doing.
Yeah, and it's important just to kind of recap, I guess, Gabelman's investigation, at least the latest. And, you know, you broke this first, too. He is way over budget, according to open record laws. He's about near $1 million, about $900,000 right now. And that is what taxpayers are going to ultimately have to pay. Now, whether or not all of that is going to be the final total is the big question. I know Speaker Voss said, well, some of that doesn't count. I don't know if I'm going to count the court proceedings. So it's kind of just a wait and see. But it is still, I think, not unexpected to see that dollar amount, JR, because of what we've known from the beginning of how much longer this was, anticipated to go on.
Yeah, there's still the cap of the $676,000 on the actual operation of the investigation. There's no cap on legal bills. I have looked at the legal bills. They are piling up. They keep coming in. We still have a July hearing in one of the cases of, that he's involved in. So that's going to keep ticking up. Where it ends, I'm not sure.
And when I asked Speaker Voss about this, just about the investigating being quote-unquote paused for Gabelman to focus on his legal challenges in court, Voss said, well, it doesn't necessarily mean he can't take phone calls and do some work on the side. So take that as you will, but it seems like Gabelman kind of has his hands, I guess, hands in two pots. He's working on the legal fights and also still reviewing those concerns and his investigation overall about what happened in the 2020 election. I think that will do it this week, JR. We got a lot covered this week. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you next week. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm JR Ross.
Take care.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.